Hello, everybody, and welcome to this week's episode of the Hollywood Podcast, covering the latest in film, TV, streaming, and social media. I'm your host, Max Geschwind. Stay tuned for today's episode.
I'm so excited to be joined by the Oscar-nominated sound team behind Mission Impossible Dead Reckoning Part 1. We have sound mixer Chris Monroe, who's a two-time Oscar winner for Black Hawk Down and Gravity, in addition to his nominations for The Mummy and Captain Phillips. We have Chris Burden, who's been nominated for Captain Phillips as well and won the Oscar last year for Top Gun Maverick. Mark Taylor also won last year for Top Gun Maverick, in addition to 1917 and additional nominations for Captain Phillips as well and The Martian and No Time to Die. And then we have sound editor James Mather, who won last year also for Top Gun Maverick and was nominated the year before for Belfast. In total, 18 Oscar nominations and 6 wins between the four of you. So it's a great honor to be able to speak with the team today. Thank you all for joining me.
Thank you for the stats.
Thank you for the stats.
Those are very impressive. I hadn't realized I was in such illustrious
James, we've been telling you that for ages, but you just don't listen.
Yes, part of my job, I don't listen.
James, I actually do want to start with you, and then we could go with the Chris's after, but I believe the three of you worked on previous Mission Impossible films before and with Christopher McQuarrie. So how was working on this installment of the franchise different from the previous one or ones in the case of James? I believe you worked, this is your third. How was it different?
It was very different in that there were two films being made simultaneously and we were in the throes of a global pandemic. But even that doesn't stop Tom Cruise and Christopher McQuarrie in their tenacity and their determination to get the film done, get the job done. So it was very different. I mean, there was a lot more pressure. I mean, Chris Monroe will be able to elaborate more, but I think that generally the shoot was a lot harder for the fact that getting to places was difficult. And, you know, as we all know, there were very tight restrictions with crew members and cast members. So it just made for a much more difficult strategic maneuver. In terms of the creative aspect of the soundtrack, we had sections of the movie over a longer period of time. We weren't on it solely for the whole 2 years or so that we spent time with it, but we did have periods of time where we'd do a month here or a couple of weeks there on sequences that were kind of sitting pretty and looked like they were going to stay locked for a little bit. And that worked really well. That gave us a chance to be able to really go for it and then put our tools down and come back to it. It's always good coming back to something. It gives you a fresh perspective and it's never quite how you remember it. So a little bit of distance, I find, is a very helpful perspective.
And Chris Bird and Chris Monroe, you both worked on Fallout before Dead Reckoning. How was that helpful in coming on board this next installment?
Why don't you start, Chris?
Okay. So this is also like James, this is my third Mission Impossible, and like James, I've also worked on other movies with Tom and McHugh. I think the most important thing is probably what James has said is, you know, we made this at the time of COVID, so we really had to change the way we did things. It also meant that it was a very long shoot. You know, I actually started on a movie in 2019, started planning, and we were about to start shooting in 2020 in Venice. And 2 days before we were due to start shooting, COVID broke, and then we were down for, you know, until the end of the year. So it was very different, and we had to find a lot of different ways of doing things. So there are, you know, because of COVID, there were lots of restrictions about how, you know, we couldn't work closely to each other. So we had to develop intercom systems and different systems that could keep us shooting should somebody get COVID. For instance, you know, we had a process where if one of the head of the department were to test positive, you know, we could still connect them via internet to the set from isolation from their rooms. We also had to record in different ways because we, you know, we couldn't all pile into a car in the Rome car chases, or we couldn't all get in a boat or be close to each other in Venice. So we used a lot of different techniques. Mainly, we used a lot of radio mics, which had a recording capability. So we recorded lots of separate tracks of people, and then, you know, my job at the end of the day was putting those tracks together and getting them together so that we could deliver them to our editor, Eddie, so that you know, we had dailies and we had a cutting copy in much the same way, so that he could edit in the same way he normally did. But you know, I think we're all pretty pleased with the results, and I think it's probably, you know, we learned a lot from COVID, and I think a lot of the things that a lot of the processes that we adopted we'll be keeping.
Chris Burden, anything to add?
Yeah, I mean, from my point of view, I came on to Full Out quite late, but I'd worked with Tom Cruise before on Edge of Tomorrow, and it is quite interesting to, as a mixer, you spend slightly less time than the floor recorders, like Chris and James's editorial team, so you see it in slightly smaller sections of time, how the films change and maybe how the approach changes. And I would just say that we've always felt with the team of Tom and Chris McQuarrie and Eddie Hamilton, the editor, just how important sound has been to the films they make, especially action movies and multi-layered big set-piece movies. It feels like that's evolved as well over time. There's just more and more sort of expectation, excitement about what we can do sound-wise. And that's not to say that early work was in any way less... Well, I suppose I'm saying that in a sense, not less, but we just, the sort of realization that how we've all sort of matured and what we want to do and what we want to achieve and what we've, each film, we want to raise the bar a bit. And that comes from the top, from the filmmakers, and also comes from us as a team. So, and then, you know, and then you add, we had got Mark Taylor came in on, Marky Mark came in on Top Gun, and that's all part of the process, really, you know. And exciting to be part of. Just as I said, I came in a bit later than James and Chris.
Mark, correct me if I'm wrong, but I believe this was your first Mission Impossible film. Was there any sort of learning curve you had coming on to Dead Reckoning and understanding the sonic work of the previous installments, or did you come on to Dead Reckoning just as you would any other project?
I came on pretty much as I would Brennial. I'd previously, like the year before, we'd done Top Gun with Chris and Tom, so I had an understanding of their sensibilities. I've known James and Chris, known James and both Chris's for many years. So there wasn't any kind of like, oh, you know, being thrown in the deep end. It's just, I just kind of do what I do and hope that people like it, which I think they did. But there was no kind of preconceptions on my part. I'm quite naive in a way. I just, you know, sit down, do my thing and hope people like it.
I have to touch on the action sequence that I think offered the first sneak peek for audiences looking at this film, which was the death-defying motorcycle jump that I think was so heavily marketed in the months leading up to the film. Were you guys aware that the motorcycle jump was going to serve as this major piece of, I guess you would say, advertisement and promoting the film months in advance of the release? And if so, was there I know there was obviously a lot of pressure across the board to do it right, you know, across all the action sequences throughout the film. But if you could touch on the particular pressure and getting the sound right for that motorcycle jump, which exposed so many people to your work in this film for the first time months before it came out.
Well, strangely enough, there was quite a strong feeling that we shouldn't garnish it too much, that we should hold back, keep our powder dry for when the film comes out and the soundtrack is then the texture that incorporates that stunt with all the rest of the story arc and everything else around it. So the build up and everything to it clearly needed, you know, what happens in the movie is very much part of the process of the movie soundtrack. And so it was felt, and Tom and McHugh were very, very keen that the audience got to see the process on production, not the sort of glorious full finished rendered end effects, end sound. They wanted people to see it was real, and that's a big deal for them all the way through these movies, that Tom's stunts are real. It's not a stuntman, it's him. And this was promoting the movie, but it was promoting the level of technique and danger and the safety and all the details that go into making what lasts for a minute and a half on the screen. It is months and months and months of training and rehearsing and repeating and repeating and repeating. And so they wanted that to be the essence. And so I think all we did in a very short period of time is run the tracks that we were given by the editor through a desk. And really, you know, if we could clarify a few things and help a few bits and pieces, we would. But it was more just a case of, let's hear it in a mixing theater. Let's make sure it's not going to hurt anybody's ears. Let's make sure it sounds rough, ready, keep the production sound energy driving this section so that everybody, they didn't want it to be manicured. They wanted it to be spit and sawdust, you know. So actually it was quite good for us because it meant that we didn't have to try and come up with a conceived ideas and styles and textures and everything else until we knew what the world around it was, because that would have pushed us in a direction we may not have followed.
Go ahead, Chris.
Sorry, I was going to say, I think there's something that, you know, you wonder, why would you release that footage of one of the biggest stunts in the movie so far ahead of its release? But of course it was, you know, we've been down for almost a year because of COVID. You know, an audience wanted, you know, needed some kind of excitement, and it was something to release then. It was actually the first thing we shot when we got back after the long break of COVID. So there was some excitement in actually putting that out, because we now that we've been delayed so much, we probably missed our first release date. And, you know, the audience were hungry for what was to come. And it was great for us because, as James said, you know, the whole thing of Tom doing his own stunts and reality means that there's a big challenge for all of us in making sure that Mission Impossible sounds real. You know, it's not like there's a stunt double doing these things and then, you know, some kind of off, you know, some offline dialogue was put on afterwards. This is all shot live, and it's Tom, and we don't know what's going to happen. You know, he's trained for a long time, but we don't actually know what's going to happen on the day until it happens. And so it's the same excitement for us as there is for the audience when it first comes out.
I'm glad that you mentioned. Oh yeah, go ahead, Chris.
No, I'm just going to say, yeah, so the fun and excitement for us was that we had this raw footage that provided the trail of the real stunt being done and everything, which had its own drama. But then we had, as James said, we had the storyline. We had Tom arriving at the cliff edge with a lot of humor and then building up, the tension building up. So we had the combination of our storyline getting us to this incredible stunt, but really an incredible moment visually, sonically, musically in the movie. So we had that ability story-wise and rhythm-wise to really amp up that excitement. And it happened, you recognize it musically towards the end, sonically we were able to, you know, make the sound effects come and go and really dynamic as Ethan goes off the cliff. So we always knew we had that next fully formed bit of filmmaking that we were going to go to from having seen the raw trailer. So, you know, that was always there ready for us, you know, to enjoy.
Yeah, and probably the most important or most suspenseful part of that sequence is when the sound dropped and you entered into just a moment of silence when you don't see Ethan and you're with him, but then you're not with him and you're uncertain about his fate. But then obviously the sound comes back when and you see him. Well, I want to touch on, you mentioned, Chris Monroe, no stunt doubles. This was Tom and the cast, you know, doing the stunts themselves, and you really felt the grit and the exertion of the actors performing. Can you share how that visceral authenticity that the actors emitted during their stunts made the sound more natural and real, as opposed to it being stunt work, stunt double work?
Yeah, sure. I think it doesn't only just make the audio real, it makes, you know, it gives the whole film authenticity. I mean, Tom's really keen on things sounding real, everything being real, the whole experience being real. So the Rome car chases, for example, you know, we have no idea how much of that dialogue is going to happen. A lot of that dialogue happens during the chases, but because Grace is actually driving and Ethan are actually driving, the two actors are actually driving and actually carrying out those stunts, their dialogue is part of the action. And so what we have is, I think what we have is a very interesting movie, really, because very rarely do you have this much dialogue in an action movie. But what you also have is performance. So I think what makes a Mission Impossible is very much that it's not just an action movie. It's a performance piece packed with action.
I'm sure Tom was very involved working with you guys and understanding what the sonic feeling of the motorcycle jump and all the other scenes in the film were, for that matter. Mark, we could start with you, since I know you've worked with Tom going back over a decade now.
Is it really that long?
Yeah, Edge of Tomorrow, 2014. Yeah, 10 years. God. But if you could talk about, I guess, maybe the difference working with him that first time around versus now, was there a shorthand that you had with him that made working with him easier?
The first time we worked with him on Edge, we didn't see Tom. I didn't see Tom until fairly late on in the process, because I wasn't involved in any temp mixes. I came on to do pre-mixing and final mix, and I was slightly awestruck that the star of the movie was going to turn up for a screening in town, give us notes, and then come back to where we were mixing and perform lines of dialogue he wasn't happy with, be completely into the character, into the movie, into the whole process. So when we did Top Gun, I was kind of pre-warned. And then again, you know, just you feed off his energy. You feed off the fact that, you know, like he was training for Mission while we were doing Top Gun. And he'd been at it all day, but still had the time to come in and see what we were up to on Top Gun. And then, so when you get to a stunt where and I've seen the raw footage where you're basically on a mountain with this. I've ridden a motorbike. I've never jumped off of a mountain. I hope never to do it, obviously without a parachute. That gives you an added impetus to make it as good as it can be and as real as it can be. And also he is a very good guide as to what it should be like, you know, like when we did Top Gun, some of the guidance he gave us at the time just seemed a little bit left field. But then when you watch it back, you go, well, he's absolutely right. And he was absolutely right about the motorbike jump and the fight in Venice. He was there. He was doing it. He knows what it sounded like. He knows what he wants it to sound like. And so you can't kind of pull the wool over his eyes. You just get on and do it, and to the best of your abilities.
It's very, can I jump in? It's very interesting watching him. He's always been a student of film. He's always been obsessed with movies and, you know, going all the way back. And there's a lot of homage in the performances that he does that you feel you feel familiar with. And you realize, yeah, he's got the character element from something. Or there's a shot, the train scene in this film, for example, is taken from a film with Buster Keaton. And so him and McHugh really have developed this sort of relationship that is enriching in the history of cinema. They are very passionate about the future of cinema, and he's become incredibly hands-on, more so as we've gone through the process productions with him, about every aspect of the filmmaking process. So he's you know, he's now producing, and he's very much involved in the soundtrack on this movie. He spent a lot of time with us reviewing, and he'd be jumping into the stage when McHugh was working on the score and vice versa. And so he really engages more than he did on previous films. We had more of him on this movie than we had on previous Mission Impossibles, a lot more. And that was partly down to the fact they were doing two films at the same time, so they were working together all the way through. But it's his passion for storytelling in every field, every technical aspect. And he has a very simple mantra. He wants to feel it. And he wants to feel it acoustically. He wants to feel it visually. He wants to feel like you're in the car with him. He wants to feel like he is back out in the canyon and the wind is blowing, you know, trying to blow him off the top of the train. Or he is stuck in a tunnel and the train is any minute now, he could slip off. He's got such a visceral take on the process. So he is... he's a consummate filmmaker. It's, you know, you don't get Chris Nolan sort of jumping off a cliff on a bike or running around in front of the camera. Tom's got this very a style which is like nobody else that I can think of. And his filmmaking passion is becoming, or seemingly becoming, more and more ingrained in the projects that he works on.
I have to touch on the final scene, the train scene. I don't think I remember the last time I'd been so at the edge of my seat and maintaining such a high level of suspense during that thrilling sequence. Can you share what your influences were behind that particular sequence? And we can start with anyone.
Chris Munro.
Yeah, maybe I could just start, because, you know, so much of this this sequence is, you know, we all had a part in it. And I think it's a great example of how we have all worked so much together in the past and how, you know, we are very much a team. You know, one of the things from my point of view is the, you know, the dialogue and the action that's on top of the roof of the train. That's on a train that's moving at 60 miles an hour. I mean, that's a real train. Then, of course, the interior is done on gimbals, on a set. And of course, that's where James and of course Mark really come in with all the effects. And of course, you know, we're getting as much production dialogue as we can during all of this.
It's incredible how much of it is going back to Chris's point about it's a dialogue movie with action. You know, all that storyline that runs through the whole train piece between Grace and Ethan is vital to making the audience feel connected to their plight, to their, and that already creates a breathless kind of high energy jeopardy. And McHugh is very clear that he's not a fan of having music and effects clamoring at the same time to try and achieve the same effect, the same experience for the audience. So he very, very astutely balances between hard effects, the sound design, and music coming in to really give you a surge of emotion and to give you that resolve or push you to the next level. And so it gives us a lot of room, dynamically, an awful lot of room and articulation to work with the dialogues and to preempt where they're going to be, to then enhance where they are, and then to kick them out of where they've been into the next carriage or onto the next, you know, the as it drops. So we're also getting cutaways to give us respite, you know, of a tiny ticking bomb on the bridge. There's so many different shifts within the edit that Eddie Hamilton makes with McHugh that allows us to enhance and encourage that audience breathless. What's going to happen next? I don't believe this is happening. This can't be. Oh my, this is insane. You know, that kind of that response that they want to garnish from the audience is all that they're doing. All they care about is that the audience is absolutely 110% on that train with them and feeling every wisp of air and every boiling pan. And you know, it's and however they get us to do that, that's what they orchestrate and they drive and they push and they work and they tweak. And, you know, it's the other thing about those elements, those scenes that we work on together with them, is that it's an extraordinary opportunity to share people's subjectivity. Everybody has a different idea about how a sound should play through, or how an impact should jump out at the audience, or how dynamically the range should shift. And because of the time we've spent, we get pretty close, but there's always something. There's always a little bit of a tweak that they want to do, and it always makes a difference. It always does something. And somebody within the team will come up with an idea that will just create that for the filmmakers. So it's exhilarating for us on the stage as well. It's a great working environment. It's so much fun, and it's hard. It's really hard.
Yeah. Go ahead, Chris.
Just quickly to say, it's interesting because the arc of that is just rising and rising in tension, and it just keeps going, And it's interesting, James is talking about the respite that happens. And we are, again, we're fortunate that the scripting and the storyline allows there to be respite in terms of smile and humor in amongst it, even if it's the danger of the kitchen scene with the oil and everything. But even those moments are so finely honed visually and sonically, hopefully from our point of view, you enjoy those. And the piano and the sound of the piano and Hayley Atwell's performance there and everything, there are still moments where we really are going into, as Chris says, the characters, that the stuff allows us to do that, even though the whole thing is just this incredibly dangerous sequence where they appear like they're about to die every few seconds. So there's so many nice layers as we get there, but the tension keeps rising, but there's lovely subtleties and cutaways and bits of respite. So it means that you're not just smashing the audience in the face for the whole time and just keeping on raising the bar. So it's a great thing to have on a sequence like that.
Yeah. And I think that falls in line too to the different tone that this film takes compared to the personal or the previous films, which is that this has a definitely more personal storyline with Ethan's growing awareness of his responsibility to the rest of the team. And I think in a way it serves as more of a character driven and more intimate story than the previous installments had, for sure, while still obviously having the action and all the rest that were is typical to see in these installments. Well, my last question, I need to touch on the entity, which is the antagonist in this film, that AI property that goes rogue and achieves sentience. And can you talk about what your primary sonic influences were in creating the entity? And we can start with anyone.
The entity was originally going to be a musical phrase. It was going to be a character theme in the music, in the score. And it was felt by a friend of the director's that it needed more. It needed more of an identity. It needed to be clearer, slightly more defined. So as a result, in so many of these occasions, you know, the visual effects team got to work and we got to work, and we wanted something that was familiar. We wanted something that was digital and cool, and it had to have this invasive, slightly almost like a virus that was, you know, working its way through as the storyline promotes. And so we were trying, we were listening to lots of things, and we didn't really, it's very hard to know when a sound is going to work, because it's like a character in the movie that actually hasn't got any dialogue or hasn't got an arc. It hadn't found its arc until the sound was put into the movie, let's put it that way. And then once the sound was discovered, there were opportunities where that could feature. There's a bit where the Fiat drives past a street camera, and there's a tiny bit of entity in that. And suddenly this little sound, this signature sound, could start being peppered throughout the movie to allow the audience, or those that got it, okay, the entity is omnipresent. It's everywhere. And it is so from the first submarine sequence. And it was quite late in the day in the process, and it was a sound that was found by Fluke. It was a piece of corrupt hardware that distorted sound when you played it through it, and it actually turned out to be pretty much what we used. We everybody created a chain of different plugins that worked to help the.
I mean, just to say, it was as as James talked about, it really was something quite late in the day in mixing terms. And it was such an important sound. So it's really, you know, again, and you learn, despite how experienced you are, things can happen quite late, become so profound for the movie, you know, and it was ended up being very confidently used as the character in the movie. So, but as I said, we were quite late determining how it was going to play.
I like the fact that it's actually the entity sound can be coming from a camera in Rome or nightclub speakers in Venice. And it also finishes the movie. It's quite a character.
And one final question. I don't know if you're all working on part two. I know, James, you are. So maybe we could start with you, James. But if you could offer any a sneak peek at what the sound sounds like in part two. Obviously, the Dead Reckoning part one serves as this sort of two-part sort feeling of finality in this decades-long franchise. However, you never know. There could be more after of Dead Reckoning part two. But I'd imagine that the sound of part two just will increase the level of intensity and thrill and suspense that we've already experienced in part one. James, if we want to start with you on what we have to expect.
I believe so. Everything you just said, I believe that's the case. I think obviously there is an unresolved denouement with Gabriel and Ethan. And so I believe that the storyline of the second movie will bring us to a finale where everything is resolved. But in getting there will be a vast amount of action and humor.
Well, congratulations to all of you on yet another Oscar nomination for your exceptional work in this latest installment of the Mission Impossible franchise.
Thank you
all taking the time.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thanks, Max. Thank you, mate.
Thanks so much for tuning in. Please take a moment to subscribe to The Hollywood Podcast for free on iTunes or your favorite podcast app. Until next time, you can follow me on Instagram and Twitter @Max Geschwind. Thanks for listening.